Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the LSE. I'm Neil Hobhouse. I'm a governor of the school and a trustee of the Cities Programme. The Cities Programme conceived the Jane Jacobs lectures and named them after an American sociologist now in her late 90s, I think, who somewhat more than 30 years ago was the first to say to the architectural and planning professionals of the modern movement that if they wanted their buildings to work, it would be better if they examined the way that people lived and worked in cities. Last week, we heard Chris Smith, the Minister of State for the Arts, talk about the intransigence of the South Bank site in rather this context. And I think it's logical now to move to Trafalgar Square and its surroundings. And for those of you who don't know, what's happening in Trafalgar Square is the most important public space project certainly in London, since the Festival of Britain. And it's given a kind of impetus to the Dixon Jones scheme for the National Gallery and Eric Parry's master plan for St. Martin in the Fields, another very complicated site that's adjacent. I'm very pleased to see that both Jeremy Dixon and Ed Jones and Eric Parry, who's here to my right, are with us tonight. We're very grateful to Charles Somerset Smith for agreeing to give this talk as the last year appointed director of the National Gallery. And he's going to talk to us about the engagement of the gallery with the square and with the public realm. He's ideally qualified to do this, both as a distinguished architectural historian, and for 8 years before his move to the National Gallery as director of the National Portrait Gallery, which he transformed both architecturally and in terms of how it presented itself to the public. And I think, in a sense, most to his credit, without diluting at all the scholarly and historical mission of the Portrait Gallery. The format of these events is very, very straightforward. Charles is going to talk for about 40 minutes. I'm then going to ask Eric Parry, who I'll introduce to respond to him, and we will then throw the floor open to the discussion open to the floor. I should also add that on Thursday of this week, John Tusso, who's the director of the Barbican, is going to talk about the Barbican in a very similar context, and all of you would be very welcome to come and join us. Thank you.
Thank you. Talking makes it sound very informal, but I've written it, so it's very, very formal. But I was very pleased to have been invited to give the second in this series of Jane Jacobs lectures, following on from Chris Smith last week. And I'm grateful to Neil Hobhouse and Richard Sennett for suggesting it, not least because the invitation sometime early in the autumn has compelled me to think carefully about a set of issues which I would like to think would have been dear to Jane Jacobs' heart. That is, what is going to be the effect of the pedestrianisation of Trafalgar Square? Is it going to succeed in its intention of creating a new heart to civic London? Is it going to fulfil Jane Jacobs' precepts for a lively new heart to the experience of the metropolis? Or is it instead going to be too chilly, too lacking in variety of texture and mixed use, too commemorative and too monumental? So far as I'm concerned, as you might guess, the big issue concerning the pedestrianisation of Trafalgar Square is what are going to be its consequences for the National Gallery the building which, more than any other, dominates the north side of the square. What I've chosen to do in the lecture is to give a brief historical account of the changing relationship of the National Gallery to Trafalgar Square as a case study of the relationship of a particular urban monument to its civic surroundings. Chris Smith's lecture last week was an admirable survey of the nature of the relationship between lottery funding and its consequences for urban regeneration. My lecture is more of a case study of one particular arts institution and the nature of its relationship to its urban setting. My intention is to look at changing attitudes to civic space, to the workings of a great metropolitan capital, and to how these issues of urban planning might relate to one's understanding and interpretation of the National Gallery, not just as a great collection of art, a place for the experience of painting, but also as an important early 19th century public building with responsibilities to its locality and to its physical and civic surroundings. So I'm going to start by going back to mid-18th century London, if I can get these slides to work, to the heart of the filthy, noisy, ill-planned city, which was, at the same time, the greatest and most productive capital city in the world, stretching all the way from Hyde Park Corner in the west to Limehouse in the east, a distance of 8 miles. I'm proposing to look at the area which is now occupied by the National Gallery in John Roke's microcosmic map of London. I may say that, as with any map, the point you actually want to look at is on the fold of the paper. It was first announced cartographic project in 1737, begun during the latter part of 1739, engraved by Hogarth's friend John Pine, and finally advertised as being available for sale in the General Advertiser on the 2nd of May, 1746. Here, if you look in the just above the join, we find Charing Cross as the intersection between three of the great arteries of central London. To the south lies Whitehall, the carriageway of official London, which led down past what is described on the map as the Admiralty Office, a Palladian building of the 1720s by Thomas Ripley. It's the area which lies behind the slightly later screen. Beyond is now the Horse Guards on the right-hand side of the street, but presumably, as shown on the map, was the old Horse Guards, built just after the Restoration, described in 1745 by Lords Delawarr and Cadogan, the colonels of the Horse Guards, as in a very rotten and decayed condition, having been supported many years by props. It was rebuilt shortly thereafter to a design by William Kent. On the left was Inigo Jones's great banqueting house, not a good slide, I'm afraid, the most Italianate building in London, and beyond was New Palace Yard and Westminster Hall at the end of the street. To the east of Charing Cross was the Strand, which led past Northumberland House. This is rather an amazing photograph by Fox Talbot, done before its demolition. It was a grand early Stuart palace fronted by a great gatehouse like an Oxford college. To the west was Cockspur Street and the Haymarket, the site of the Queen's Theatre, Vanbrugh's Opera House, which had been built in the first decade of the 18th century. Charing Cross itself was the site, as indeed it still is, now surrounded by a swirl of taxis, of an equestrian monument to Charles I by Hubert Le Sueur, a French sculptor at the court of Charles I. It was placed here in 1675 as a memorial to the executed king within sight of the banqueting house where the scaffold had been placed, and it marks the centre of London, the place from which all measurements of distance are taken, based on the fact that from medieval times onwards, it was the great crossroads at the heart of the city. Immediately to the north of Charing Cross lay the Royal Mews, the Great Mews, as it was known, a huge and quite complicated site, like an equestrian Versailles, with an entrance portico flanked by Palladian towers and leading to a big courtyard with a horse pond in the middle. In front lay the so-called Great Stable, a building designed by William Kent and a drawing for which is now in the Yale Center for British Art. A building, as you see, of considerable grandeur and whose form is perhaps to some extent echoed by the current National Gallery. It has a grand entrance portico flanked by subsidiary entrances lying like a ghost behind the form of Wilkins's facade. Immediately to the east of the Royal Mews was St. Martin's in the Fields, not as now dominating its surroundings, but tapped into a bend in the road at the bottom of St. Martin's Lane. St. Martin's in the Fields is, of course, one of the great churches of early 18th century London, the model for so many churches in New England, with its combination of portico and steeple, and quite simple, rather barn-like interior, with a prominent pulpit and galleries on three sides. This, then, was the heart of mid-18th century London, disorderly, dirty, teeming with human traffic, the product of a city which had grown organically westwards, with only occasional attempts to contain its growth in ordered urban spaces, like Soho Square to the north and St. James's Square to the west. What becomes clear is that even in the mid-18th century, Charing Cross had a certain symbolic importance within the city as the intersection between that part of London which was dominated by Parliament, St. James's Palace, where the court resided, and Covent Garden, the centre of a large area of small shops selling luxury goods and the workshops in the yards off St. Martin's Lane. It was the presence of the old Royal Mews, a grand axial building facing onto an open space at the centre of the city, which perhaps helped to inform plans in the late 1820s to replace the Mews with a set of buildings to house the learned institutions. An open public space was planned to replace an enclosed space which had previously been unseen by the public and was used only to house the royal horse. So, if we now turn to the early 19th century, to the period of civic and urban reform, when the architect John Nash was laying out Regent Street in a great swathe through the centre of the city, cutting southwards from Regent's Park in the north through the old streets and dividing the smarter parts of the West End from the less salubrious neighbourhood of Soho. Following the success of the major clearance of houses to create Regent Street, Nash was instructed by the new street commissioners to devise a more commodious access from the Houses of Parliament to the British Museum and the numerous and respectably occupied new buildings in the part of the metropolis in which the National Repository is now to be permanently established. Nash proposed the demolition of the Royal Mews and of a block immediately to its east, and suggested the construction of a new National Gallery on the north side of the square, which would thereby be created, a building to contain the Athenaeum Club and the Royal Academy of Literature to the east, and in the centre of the square, immediately behind the equestrian statue of Charles I, a colonnaded temple based on the Parthenon, which was to house the Royal Academy. By 1826, the small group of trustees of the newly established National Gallery, which had opened its doors to the public on May 1, 1824, were beginning to realise that John Julius Angerstein's private house in Pall Mall, which had been acquired for the purposes of showing his pictures, was going to be grotesquely inadequate if it was ever going to fulfil the aspirations to establish a genuinely national collection. The cartoon of this period contrasts Angerstein's private house in Pall Mall, below, the home of the British National Collection, with the Louvre above, the great palace which was used to house the booty which Napoleon had assembled from all over Europe. As so often in British history, new developments in state funding were motivated by a realisation that the French were able to do things so much better. But there was also an awareness that Ludwig I, the King of Bavaria, was busy assembling works of art for his Glyptothek and in due course the Alte Pinakothek in Munich. And 1826 was the year that Carl Friedrich Schinkel visited Britain and France in order to study new architectural developments in Britain as possible models for his proposed Altersmuseum in Berlin. So, it should not surprise us that the years between 1826 and 1838, the year of the opening of the National Gallery in its new home in Trafalgar Square, were years which saw the development of a number of schemes for a National Gallery to rival the Louvre. On the 16th of September 1831, the trustees of the National Gallery decided that the gallery should be rehoused in the Royal Mews. Shortly afterwards, William Wilkins published a letter to Viscount Goderich, in which, somewhat opportunistically, he described the unsatisfactory nature of the National Gallery's then current accommodation in Pall Mall, thereby staking his claim to be involved in the design or redesign of a new one. To begin with, the idea was simply to convert the Royal Mews, but since this was going to cost the princely sum of £35,000, it was agreed that it might be just as cheap and much more efficient to tear the Mews down and start afresh. C.R. Cockerill proposed a building which was to have been 400 foot long with the National Gallery housed over shops. The design sadly does not survive. Wilkins's proposals were more modest and consisted of a building one room deep to house not only the National Gallery but also the Royal Academy. Not surprisingly, Wilkins won the contract. If truth be told, Wilkins was not the most exciting architect of his period. Lacking the vitality and sometimes gimcrack brilliance of his contemporary John Nash, or the more scholarly earnestness of C.R. Cockerill, who was to win the competition to design the new Ashmolean Museum in Oxford in 1839. But Wilkins, by the early 1830s, had had long experience of designing public buildings, having begun his architectural career designing new premises for the East India College in Hertfordshire and Downing College in Cambridge, and more recently been responsible for the scholarly revival of Gothic at Trinity and King's College, Cambridge, and at Corpus Christi, Cambridge, and also for the fine new buildings at University College London, I'm not sure about this slide which I took last week, which exemplified the Benthamite view of the benefits of wider public access to learning. Nor does Wilkins really deserve to be criticised to too great an extent for the defects of the National Gallery, as he was hobbled throughout by the deep-seated and habitual mean-spiritedness of the British Parliament and its unwillingness to conceive of a genuinely monumental building, even including the requirement that Wilkins should reuse the columns of Carlton House, which was in the process of being dismantled. In fact, if one compares the building as built with the reconstruction of Wilkins's original, more monumental aspirations, I'd actually never seen this drawing before, you can see that some of the defects of the final design derive from the fact that there's a single dome, which is rather too small, rather than the original three which were proposed, and that the facade was stripped of the monumental sculpture which would have animated it and given it a greater sense of commemorative dignity. The result of Wilkins's various plans and proposals was a building which has always been regarded as slightly too insignificant for its purposes. Fine when it's viewed from the side at the end of Nash's designs for Lower Regent Street, when it acts as a frame for Gibbs's St. Martin's in the Fields, but much less effective when it's viewed from in front, when it may legitimately be thought too long and low to be regarded as a major monument of the 19th century city. I hope that by now I've given you enough of a sense of the original circumstances of the building of the National Gallery. I want now to shoot forwards past 1840, when a select committee met to consider the creation of a terrace in front of the National Gallery, past the construction of Nelson's Column, another rather amazing photograph by Fox Talbot, Past 1848, when there were Chartist riots in Trafalgar Square. Past the 1850s, when there were plans to relocate the National Gallery in South Kensington. Past the 1860s, when the Royal Academy was relocated to Burlington House in Piccadilly, and when there were further plans to demolish Wilkins's building and start afresh. On to the Second World War, when Hampton's department store next door to the National Gallery was bombed, leaving a vacant site and a car park for much of the post-war period. Past the 1980s, when the plans to build a new building on the so-called Hampton site led to a bitter contest over the appropriate style, beginning with the public exhibition of the schemes which derived from the first competition, which had led to the selection of a design by Aarons, Burton and Kurelek. Past the Prince of Wales's famous speech on the 30th of May 1984, it could have been 1884, to the RIBA, which denounced the scheme by Aarons, Burton and Kurelek as a monstrous carbuncle on the face of a much-loved friend, past the opening of the new Sainsbury wing designed by Robert Venturi and Denise Scott Brown, until we come to the 1990s, when Trafalgar Square had degenerated into being a rather disgusting big roundabout, full of an endless traffic jam of cars, taxis and tourist buses, which very few people would bother to navigate, and if they did, found a rather impoverished public space full of forlorn Japanese tourists and hamburger salesmen who were licensed by the Department of National Heritage, the body which had responsibility for overseeing the square. So how was it that someone in London had the foresight to commission Sir Norman Foster to draw up a new scheme for the square? Who was it who was able to persuade Westminster City Council, the Government Office for London, the Department for Culture, Media and Sport, the Parliamentary Works Directorate, the Traffic Director for London, amongst many other public bodies, to work together on a new scheme which has the potential of revitalising and reinterpreting this historic space in the centre of London? I do not know the exact history of the scheme, nor, so far as I am aware, has it yet been properly recorded. As so often happens in urban history, it's far easier to find out and analyse what happened in the 1830s than it is in the 1990s. What I do know is that Jacob Rothschild, the Svengali behind a large number of public works in London, had been systematically agitating for something to be done about the state of Trafalgar Square during his time as chairman of the trustees of the National Gallery, and that he was in a position to offer the possibility of funding a new scheme when he became chairman of the National Heritage Memorial Fund, the body which, in 1993, was given charge of the Heritage Lottery Fund. Richard Rogers provided a blueprint for the development of Trafalgar Square as part of his submission for the original National Gallery competition, which was subsequently shown at the Royal Academy under the title London as It Could Be, and was subsequently reproduced in the book A New London, which he wrote jointly with Mark Fisher. I also know John Selwyn Gummer, when he was Secretary of State for the Environment, assembled a team to work on a revived square in 1996, that once Norman Foster had been appointed to undertake a study of Trafalgar Square, Whitehall and the surrounding area in November 1996, that a series of public debates were held at the Methodist Hall, organised, as I remember, by Ricky Burdett, I think, and that Norman Foster has himself devoted an immense amount of time and energy to pursuing a vision of a revived, traffic-free civic space at the heart of the urban realm, as imagined in his master plan, World Squares for All, now about to be unveiled as a new look Trafalgar Square. I put in slightly irrelevantly the bust of Norman Foster, because I like it and he doesn't. So what is going to be the character of this new look Trafalgar Square? Its principal, most dominant characteristic is that traffic can no longer pass in front of the National Gallery. the street in front of the National Gallery is going to become what I've been told is known colloquially by my former colleagues at the National Portrait Gallery as Charles's football pitch. In other words, a public arena in front of the Wilkins facade where visitors to the National Gallery can recuperate and promenade. Instead of a pair of lateral steps within the square leading to the front of the National Gallery, there will be a set of monumental steps leading up to it. It is, I think, inescapable that the mood of the square will change quite dramatically and become not merely much more pedestrianised, more open and more civic, but also more axial, read as a set of formal vistas from the south, so that the National Gallery will be viewed more normally, not framed from the west as part of a picturesque composition including St. Martin's in the Fields, but from the south as part of an urban composition which one might more normally expect to find in Hanover or Copenhagen. Now, the proposed changes to Trafalgar Square set the trustees of the National Gallery a challenge. Was the National Gallery going to sit back and observe the changes happening below it from a safe distance? It's Norman Foster on there. Challenging the sound system. Was it worth going to retreat behind its 19th century facade and pretend that the changes going on in front of it were nothing to do with it, even a possible threat to civic order, a manifestation of Ken Livingstone's populist agenda for London? Or was it going to adapt, to recognise that its surrounding urban environment is changing, and try to change itself in sympathy with its setting and the expectations of an early 21st century audience? The answer is that it is currently embarking on a quite complex set of changes which respond to those around it, but which I hope also retain and protect the essential spirit and character of its galleries, the balancing act which seems to me to lie at the heart of any scheme for major institutional reconstruction and regeneration. In 1998, while I was still at the National Portrait Gallery, a group of trustees of the National Gallery, led by Lady Bingham and including Patty Hopkins amongst its members, came for a morning to view the work we were doing in the construction of the Ondaatje Wing. I was one of the people who walked them round, and I was a passionate advocate for Jeremy and Ed's work, who were the architects for the Ondaatje Wing, on the grounds that both at the National Portrait Gallery and at the Royal Opera House, I think they accomplished a remarkable feat, a feat which, certainly at the Royal Opera House, has been inadequately recognised, of reinventing a historic institution in a more democratic spirit, while at the same time protecting its original character, indeed revivifying it. I think actually that's only part of the slide, which is a large format one. But I have also to confess that I was slightly miffed when I discovered not long afterwards that the architectural practice, who I had regarded as peculiar, and especially the architects of the National Portrait Gallery, had been hired to draw up a master plan for the National Gallery. It will not perhaps surprise you if I confess that I'm not quite so upset now that I am myself director of the National Gallery and find myself in the fortunate position of inheriting an extremely ambitious and comprehensive master plan for the future development of the National Gallery, which does have the potential for completely reinventing it as a public institution, revitalizing the Wilkins Building and enabling the gallery to adapt itself to the changing demands and expectations of a 21st century audience. What then are the principal characteristics of this master plan? I find it helpful to think of the National Gallery as if it were a Victorian country house, with grand public spaces on the main floor, or piano nobile, but also with a great deal of unused or underused or disused space in its interstices. You will, I suspect, be surprised if I tell you that the entire National Gallery has been constructed on a series of cross axes and that in between these cross axes there's a set of eight mostly unused, extremely large courtyards, which are never seen by the public because they lie behind the windowless walls of the gallery. I show a drawing by Jeremy, which shows the galleries marked out in red, and then the black where the courtyards are. It's a great deal of currently dead space. Underneath the main floor galleries is a rabbit warren of unused or misused spaces, which are like the servants' quarters of a Victorian country house, and which are currently occupied by the staff or by the rather disgusting public services which the gallery is currently able to offer its visitors, including lavatories which would not disgrace a Victorian prison, and a cafe which was described in a recent visitor survey rather vividly as like the canteen of a provincial university where you are yourself not a student. The plan is, in the long term, to open up the eight courtyards to public use. Here you see the first phase of it in the axonometric drawing. To provide a spine under the main floor galleries for public facilities, including better space to sit down and have a cup of coffee. You can just see where you can have a cup of coffee. And in the long term, to open up the ground floor galleries currently used as open storage for purposes of much better public display and also possibly as exhibition space. The first phase, which starts in May, will include opening up the East Door, which has been closed at least since the Second World War, improving the cafe as somewhere to come to and drop in on as a visitor to Trafalgar Square, as well as to the National Gallery. A new and better bookshop, proper lavatories, a much improved public entrance instead of the currently slightly grim cloakroom which confronts the arriving visitor. And perhaps most importantly, a restored entrance staircase which will recover the original crace decoration and provide a suitably monumental and theatrical public entrance to one of the great art galleries in the world. So, to conclude this brief survey, the National Gallery is adapting to the demands of its surroundings, transmogrifying itself in response to a changed urban dynamic. Like all great historic institutions, it's modernizing itself while at the same time, I hope, remaining true to its original spirit. It's reinventing itself for a new millennium while preserving and protecting its essential ethos as a 19th century public gallery. It's performing the balancing act which lies at the heart of any project of civic conservation, namely preserving the essential characteristics of a historic building while at the same time allowing it to change and adapt to new uses, to the expectations and demands of what I understand as the spirit of the new urbanism, which tries to understand and interpret the mood of the city in terms of the complex demands and expectations of its human traffic, treating architecture as a living organism rather than as a dead and passive mausoleum. So, when Ken Livingstone opens the new Trafalgar Square on July the 6th this year, the National Gallery will already have erected the hoardings behind which will take place its own reinvention. Thank you.
Knows whether we have a microphone on the table. Microphone.
In part, we know he's thought a lot about Trafalgar Square because of his involvement, his responsibility for the master plan of St Martin's in the Field, but also because in a series of buildings over the last few years, he has built things that, in a sense, are very managed to be both a very positive commentary on the their immediate urban surroundings. I'm thinking about Pembroke College, the extension of Pembroke College in Cambridge, and Finsbury Square, I think it was completed. I don't think it's open yet, but they're in there. And Finsbury Square, but also a very elegant, tough but elegant critique of heritage planning constraints. And what I was, I think, very
certainly very briefly, but I just in response to what I thought was an absolutely fascinating peeling back of the layers of history to reveal the condition that we have in Trafalgar Square, which as in certainly my student days was a space that was only to be challenged architecturally by the brave or the very foolish, and it's an incredibly difficult, nondescript space, a sort of in-between space that I certainly believe has been extraordinarily transformed by Norman Foster's very deft and quite underplayed topographical changes bar these great steps, and it was fascinating to see the way in which a new revelation of the physiognomy of the gallery through your eyes and through your photograph, particularly of for instance UCL, looking up to this portico, so there's an extraordinary change to the sense of enclosure to the space, which is suddenly made available because one can wander. Actually, you know, it can this field, this sort of this great plain, actually, rather than a square, one could challenge the notion of square with it, that is so clear when actually the elevational studies are put on the wall as well. It begs the question of scale, of how porous a public space can be, and I think above all, probably, it begs the question about the nature of public space as a situational space, as a framework for public activity, and the way it is inhabited. So it's the sort of narrative and thematic of this great space that is a challenge, and it's not one that can be undertaken singularly, as Nash had envisaged, because it's almost a landscape endeavor, Trafalgar Square, Nash being originally trained as a landscape designer. It's seen very picturesquely, and his response, which I thought was very interesting and I hadn't realized, was this great temple at the center. Then it stood clearly through that wonderful Fox Talbot image of the building of the column, as a kind of field where one could begin to understand a political dimension, being as it is set between the great parts of London. And which is very interesting, actually, when you look at a land use of this space, you get classically to one side very institutional, impenetrable buildings, embassy buildings, but it is a rift, a three-way rift between Soho and that tradition of printing and dialogue, and the great institutional buildings of monologue in Whitehall. Mediated by the gallery and its magnificent endeavour, which again I loved seeing that sketch of the courtyards and the sense that we're digging, you know, kind of recreating a complexity and gluing parts together, making these organisms that are actually, in the end, the definition of the square. work for the public. So it then seems to me that there's one dimension that is very much lacking, which I'd like to throw up in the air and then turn this immediately over to questions, which is that we have the in St. Martin in the Fields, a kind of contemporary in itself an absolutely sacred domain, and a contemporary vision of care and community. It's an amazingly visited place, with 700,000 visitors a year, 27 services a week and so on, but it is absolutely an extraordinary point of focus. And then the gallery itself, with all that it offers, and actually, in a way, it has a status in contemporary society as verging on, and certainly the reflective, the whole issue of memory in the museum, and touching a sort of sacredness. The question is where the political dimension of the square exists. You know, I suppose one would historically, in a European space of this significance, have expected that dialogue with political to be there in more than simply the anger of demonstration. One wonders about how that aspect of the framework for society can be grafted on. I believe the jigsaw is a really interesting one, with the South Bank being connected by the 100th Bridge, over which I walked today, with its connection with the 11th. We know that all the patterns of movement in Charles Square are radically changed. And I think it's a fascinating period in its history. So thank you, Charles, enormously for a very, very interesting discussion or lecture. And now, should we take a question?
Charles, do you want to say something about Trafalgar Square as a political space?
I was very interested to see what you've inherited and what you're doing within the gallery, and it struck me that Jane Jacobs would be passionately pro what you're doing inside the building, very, very much taken with it, as she would be with what Eric Perry is doing in and around St. Martin's in the Fields, but that she would loathe what is being done to Trafalgar Square itself. And this may be, I erase this just because it raises the issue of the politics or the sociology of the square. You've created, I don't know if you've created a football patch, but you've been given in a space which is enormously large, connected to an institution. Jane Jacobs' notion was that spaces like that should fill up with lots of contradictory, complex activities. And when we talk about pedestrian zones, what we want to do is have more different kinds of things happen in them, rather than hollow them out as places that create a kind of void in front of institutional buildings. Curiously, for her, the elimination of traffic in front of Trafalgar Square would have been seen as a kind of negative, a social negative. I can't speak for her totally, but knowing the way she feels about urban context, the trick would have been to make the square not a kind of entrance to either the church or the gallery, but something that's filled up with all sorts of contraries. Not a place that's emptier, but a place that's different.
I think it is a genuinely open question. I feel it myself, exactly how the square will work in practice. I think it will be immeasurably much better than it was before. And I was struck that in 8.5 years at the National Portrait Gallery, I'd never actually walked across it. because you always, it was just too difficult to get into the middle of it. You always walked around it, unless you were a tourist and you wanted to take a picture of yourself in front of Nelson's Column. So I think it will be a huge improvement. I think it will be a huge improvement for the National Gallery, because it will extend the sense of public space out. And instead of going onto a very narrow pavement and getting run down by a tourist bus, you will go into an open civic space. But there are two things I have sort of modest. Well, one thing that's happened already, which I think is completely bizarre, is they go to all the trouble of getting rid of traffic on the north side, and then they've diverted the entire stream of traffic from Cockspur Street round in front of Canada House, so that you get one gain, and then at the same time, and it's completely gratuitous, because there was no reason for the traffic not to run in front of the Department of Culture, and to divert it round in front of the Sainsbury Wing. So that seems to me bizarre. And also, it is very formal, and I tried in thinking about the lecture to get some sense of Norman Foster's own attitudes to the conception of urban design, and what the influences were. And as I understand it, a lot of it was in practice to do with issues of traffic management, and that when I emailed Spencer de Grey, and he said, if you want to get a sense of the volition for it, you should go back to Buchanan's studies of town planning in relationship to traffic in the 1960s. And I think there is a difference in that from my sense of Richard Rogers's scheme in connection with the Sainsbury Wing. So, but as I say, I actually think that sense of a monumental sweep, which is rather different from the traditions of picturesque planning in London, may be rather magnificent.
I'm just a visitor to the National Gallery over the last 50 years or so. Now, you have described very clearly how you propose to reshape the building. You also constantly use the phrase reinvent the gallery. And that makes me very nervous. I'm not at all certain what you mean by that. You really did not make it clear. And I rather think the National Gallery at the moment is doing quite well, particularly on Wednesdays between 2:30 and 5. I'll come back to you on that one.
Well, I should answer that immediately. I don't intend or have any intention or expectation, nor do I think it's remotely desirable to change the central experience of the main floor galleries, on which huge sums of money have been spent relatively recently to great public benefit. So that when I talk about reinventing the spaces, it's changing the nature of the relationship between the true ground floor and the square. So there's a sense of changing some aspects of the way that the gallery relates to the public sphere. Not dissimilar, not surprisingly, to what I think Ellen Jeremy did very beautifully at the National Portrait Gallery, retaining the integrity of the actual gallery spaces, as Neil said in the introduction, not changing the essential experience of the institution, but changing the overall envelope and making the experience of the institution different and encouraging more people to come, which I think is valuable and beneficial. I don't necessarily reassure you, but I hope that does something.
Corner by St. Martin in the Fields. So there'll be three entrances into the gallery, and therefore three exits out onto the square. How do you see the three working in terms of each other? Will it simply be distributing, you know, the traffic, the crowd, more equitably into the gallery, or do you think the three entrances will have different flavors? And assuming that a large number of people will be coming from the Charing Cross tube station or from the railway stations, or putting more pressure then on that corner, the new entrance into the, is it going to be some relationship, those three?
You can't completely predict. When the Sainsbury Wing opened, I mean, at the moment, of the 4.5 million visitors a year, 80% go out the portico and in the main entrance, and only 20% go to the Sainsbury Wing, which I've always found interesting because the Sainsbury Wing staircase is designed as a monumental approach to the beginning of the collection. But in fact, as I understand it, the facade, one of the reasons the facade is deliberately neutral and doesn't signal itself as a grand portico, is precisely that the trustees then and the people involved in the planning and design of it wanted to keep the portico, the main portico, Wilkins's portico as the main portico. And I would continue to expect that to be the main point of entrance for people arriving to see the gallery. So that the ground floor entrance through that door, which after all already exists, all you're doing is opening up a door which is already there, will subtly change the nature of the relationship of the gallery to the square at ground floor and have a different use. Because when you go in, you won't go into gallery space, you'll go into the cafe and the bookshop. So it's to do with those people who come intending to go to the National Gallery, I would expect to go up the steps in the way they always have previously. But I think also some people will come in at ground floor level more casually and then will find themselves upstairs. So it's a supplement thing.
I'll be right in saying that actually the final, the scheme when completed will in fact have four new entrances to the National Gallery.
And in my view, which is the view of the object, is that if you open up one of the black doors, it makes no sense not to open the other black door, which is it's a classical facade. And in reality, I think the whole scheme doesn't really make sense unless you replicate it and do the equivalent matching scheme the other side. But there are a few difficulties, mainly to do with the fact that the director's office is immediately adjacent to the other black door. It could be that as I settle into the space, I too, like my predecessor, become reluctant to move out.
Can I ask about Leicester Square in two directions? One is a sort of horror story that if this is done, what is being done to Trafalgar Square happens, it will go towards hamburger joints and Leicester Square grubbiness and lettering corners. Another more cheerful is the side of St. Mark's Square in Venice, the way you move through and suddenly here's a square. We've got a little of that. Will you do anything towards, do you want to do anything towards the two galleries, so long as you're still friends with National Portrait, being a way through? But again, can you combine a way through with stopping to see pictures properly? Can you reflect on the other square?
Well, I can particularly well because I spent this morning with planners from Westminster City Council who are doing a project in Leicester Square. And I think it is a very interesting issue. One of the things I discovered is that they hate the square because it's unbelievably lively all through the night and it causes tremendous problems to them in terms of civic order between the hours of midnight and 3 in the morning. Whereas actually, I'm embarrassed to say, I rather like the kind of roughness and seediness of Leicester Square. I've always thought, I do often walk across it, and there's something about the mixture of uses and the kind of way Soho creeps into the north side and the cinemas, which I've always found is rather lively. So I'm rather against their desire to slightly cosmeticize it. But on the other hand, I do share their view that there is a very poor relationship from Leicester Square through to Trafalgar Square. And the route south from Leicester Square by the old dental hospital and there's a hotel, there's something about it which doesn't encourage people down. The National Gallery owns the hotel, St. Vincent's House, which looks like a kind of 70s Sputnik and is possibly ripe for demolition. But, you know, that doesn't attract people down. And in fact, the Sainsbury Wing, although it was designed to have a thoroughfare, it doesn't really work, I think, in urban terms. And I think there is quite an opportunity to try and create that kind of axis up from Trafalgar Square to Leicester Square and vice versa. But I'm not clear how it should be done. I do think it could be done to an extent by public art.
Microphone coming.
Charles, I'd like to ask a question about vision, because you began your talk with that word, vision. And the thing that has been concerning me a little is that I too was wondering who had this vision, who was the person who started to push forward this whole notion for the pedestrianisation of Trafalgar Square. And I suppose if you talk about vision, you have to also think about what is this ideal square going to, how is it going to behave, how are the people within it going to behave. And I think one of the marvellous things about Trafalgar Square has been that its character has been built up through the behaviour of the people within the square. And so my question is, do you think with the new look of the square and the way in which it's being called the People's Square, there will be an overemphasis on a theatrical side of the square? There'll be an overemphasis on actually designating how people will act within the square. And if they don't act in the way in which the planners and the visionaries expect them to act, what then?
Eric's going to answer this question, as it's particularly difficult.
I'm not going to ask you to repeat that. I was expecting Charles to do that. So, well, actually, I think I'm right in saying, having met Ed Jones recently, that there's a sort of also, I mean, there's been this, I think, this difficult issue of how to settle the plans as ever, you know, in public space of the gallery with the broader field that's been established. And there's a question about things that are temporary in the space, celebration, I guess, you know, I mean, this is, I suppose, what you're asking about in terms of people's behavior. But it seems to me that there's a sort of assumption that it's empty and it's lit and it's that dreaded nighttime shot with nice lighting and no one around. That's the image of the space. Whereas it, if you start to think about the various activities, absolutely legitimate ones, obviously, that the first of all, the whole question of the crowd at a New Year's Eve, which is extraordinary, the demonstration, but also celebrations. And I think that there was a plan to work between the permanent and the impermanent with a set of steps or other devices that could allow the dialogue and connection between the gallery and the space. And somehow I feel the same thing about the way in which our very slight interventions in the public realm will create a world between the buildings and the space that will be better than just the empty space. And the sort of, and really, if you look at the way that people used Trafalgar Square, it's amazing how they would skirt it to get out of it as soon as possible. I mean, a lot of work was done with it before planning the square. And they would be able to use and create a sort of separate sense of ebb and flow that is generated by the buildings and the porosity of the buildings. So I think this, you know, that's a very important aspect. And I think that that's a very important one. It's very difficult to plan for it, but maybe there are some interventions that would help.
Eric, I start to take a fall in our direction. I don't know, Charles, whether we can mention the steps. Oh, I see. So is it not to be raised? Okay, not
issue.
Well, I mean, this is a chair topic concerning myself on the question of Charles's what's been now euphemistically described as a football field in front of the building. And this also refers to Richard Sennett's point that when we were working on the master plan, it occurred to us that once you've removed the traffic, the building could make a gesture towards the square, which is build a big flight of steps that went from the portico down into the square. And we had a number of meetings with Norman Foster before the ink had dried on his plans to put the steps where they're now being built, to discourage him from doing that, and to retain the steps at the east and west corners, and to use a flight of steps from the portico of the National Gallery into the square as a big rostrum, a big terrace to sit on. Because I think people, when they visit the National Gallery, have a great pleasure from standing in the portico and looking south. It's one of the great views. You stand there and look down Whitehall. And Jeremy and I thought that it would be a very good idea to produce a big flight of steps there, where people could sit on the steps in the sun and enjoy the weather and the fine view, and not necessarily use them as a rhetorical entrance. The other steps might still work. And I think Norman really got the message. He said he'd already sold the idea of the steps being where they were, and that was the end of that. Because we were making the point that really the axial approach is not very English. The feet don't follow the eye, they go upwards, they side steps, and take then the steps up in front of classical building, which looks as though they've removed the steps. That big blank wall looks as though that's kind of scar where, or a cauterizing where the steps might have been. And Jeremy made the point that if you had the steps and people came along and said, well, it's a very good idea now to remove the steps and put the traffic there, it would be a major row. You know? And the argument against that was that the view from the west, the steps were getting in the way of Gibbs's church. In fact, I think one of the great sadnesses with this pedestrianization, which you touched on, Charles, is the view from the west is the great view. You have the portico of Canada House on the right, Gibbs's church in deep space, and the perspective of the National Gallery looks fantastic there. When they were digging the road up, or redoing the road, you could stand there. And that's one of the great views of London that we will never see now. Our steps, I think, would have been fantastic crossing that space, but that will be. So, in answer to the question, I think there could be events there that could come from the building still and energize that city. It's the peninsula dedicated to the National Gallery with traffic.
Yes, I probably should, now that my canvas has been closed by it. But I share the architect's view that it would be wonderful to have a set of monumental steps leading down from the portico. I think it would make very good sense in relationship to the square, and I think it would help create a better sense of relationship between the building and the square. And the reason I didn't put it in is, first of all, we haven't yet agreed it. And secondly, it's known that Norman Foster, having done his steps, is wary about having two sets of monumental steps, which I am sympathetic to. And thirdly, it's completely evident, without saying it, that changing the design of the Wilkins Building will not be straightforward and will potentially be subject to an immensely complicated planning discussion. And I've taken the view that it's better to get on with what's relatively straightforward and lay the ground carefully for the future discussion about the steps, which we've ended up doing tonight, in spite of my making a political judgment that I would.
I think I saw a question in the second row.
I understand that Charing Cross was kind of a source of gossip in the 17th century, a place where people met. And it is the centre, as you say, of where London is measured. Yet that island stands alone away from Trafalgar Square in the current scheme. And I just wondered if you had any plans to try and reconnect where the statue of Charles II sits to the square, because what that would do is be getting people to move through the square and then southwards towards the seat of democracy, and also with fantastic vistas up and down the two axes, because so many tourists risk life and limb to run out onto that island.
I think that's correct. I mean, that
Charles I has not benefited from the scheme. I mean, at the moment, it is even more of a traffic island. I didn't show the photograph I took, risking life and limb to try and get, you know, within photographing distance of Charles I, because the traffic just goes round and round it. And I think that is a weakness. And I should just add that in Sylvia Hoff's question about who is ultimately responsible, in the end, although it wasn't Norman Foster's conception, I do think the nature of the square and the way it will work is more than anything owing to him. But it will be subject to adaptation in its use. And people do adapt spaces in ways which I think are not predicted by architects, so that actually how it will work in practice remains to be seen. Not least, at a relatively late stage, they've inserted a cafe sort of tucked in underneath the steps and a set of lavatories. So something which would have been purely monumental does have a cafe alongside it.
Thank you. I think we must wind up the discussion now, and I'd like to thank Charles and Eric and everybody else who's participated this evening. I hope all of you, any of you, will come to John Chu's lecture on Thursday this week. Thank you very much.